Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, investors and CEOs who are changing the face of the healthcare scene in the UK and beyond. I am a CEO and founder of a health tech venture myself called PocDoc. PocDoc support the show, so thank you very much for that. PocDoc are supercharging the cardiometabolic screening pathway with our digital app to allow anybody anywhere to deliver a full cardiovascular screen in under 8 minutes. Currently working with the NHS and a number of pharmacies. If you want to check us out, then you can just Google PocDoc or go to PocDoc.co. But anyway, thank you very much for the teams for supporting the show. As ever, thank you to everyone who's listening live on UK Health Radio. We really love the UK Health Radio platform. The show itself is one of many shows that's available on UK Health Radio. There are some incredible presenters doing incredible things, so please make sure that you check them out. And thanks, as ever, to Johan and his team for producing the show with us. Much appreciated. If you are listening on any of the podcast channels, thanks for downloading it. If you're watching us on YouTube, thanks for watching us. We actually spent most of the time thinking about Spotify, but it turns out we've just been looking at the numbers. And over the last 3 or 4 weeks, Apple Podcasts has gone absolutely bananas. So I'm not sure quite what's happened with their algorithm, but our numbers from Apple have just gone way up, which is fantastic. So anyway, thank you very much for everyone for listening. We wouldn't be here without you. Last week's show, for those of you that listened and for those of you who didn't, check it out, was with Chris Bischoff, who's the managing director of a investment fund called General Catalyst. His explanations around Babylon Health, the good and the bad, and something called Livongo, which was a very successful diabetes management platform that was bought by Teladoc for 18 billion, but then actually didn't really go that well necessarily, were hugely insightful. He was an early backer and a big backer of both. So if you have the opportunity, check out that show. This week, we have another titan of the healthcare investment space on, Jess McCready, who is principal at Octopus Ventures. Octopus Ventures, for those of you that don't know, I know we're a broad church, are one of the leading early stage and growth investors in health and healthcare technology in the UK and Europe. They also invest in other sectors, but they are certainly one of the leaders in health and healthcare and health tech. They've backed a number of companies that people may have heard of, including Quit Genius, Big Health with their app Sleepio, which was the first app ever prescribed by the NHS, which was for insomnia, Vera, Skin and Me, and Tune. So, Jess, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Very well, thank you, Steve.
Good. So, we're a broad church, so let's just jump straight into what is a principal investor, and you know, what does that involve? You know, a bit of background there might be really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. So I spend my day-to-day thinking about what are the enabling technologies and innovations that are going to transform the markets that I focus on. As a venture capital investor, as you can imagine, we take a very long-term view. So we're thinking about trends on a sort of 10-year horizon plus. As you rightly said, I spend most of my time within health tech, but also in B2B SaaS. So my job is very simply to identify the technologies that we believe will transform those markets, build a relationship with those companies, and look to support their growth, both through investment, but also through the package of support that we offer as a team. Then work with those companies, management team and board level, and then manage our relationship with them all the way through growth, and ideally through exit as well.
And why do some of these companies, why is it so important in healthcare, particularly for investment funds to support those innovators and innovative companies? Why is it particularly important in healthcare, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, very simply, it's to improve outcomes for patients and also to reduce cost. We've seen a huge amount of transition in the market, in part through COVID and what that's done to adoption, but also thinking through to some of our longer term healthcare trends. You know, 70% of our healthcare spend in the UK goes to long term chronic illness, of which, unfortunately, most of those do not have a therapeutic response or cure. And so investing in health technology, and that could be both curative, it could also be to sort of reduce the impacts of symptoms and help individuals better cope with long-term chronic disease. You know, health tech plays a hugely important role in that evolution and in that landscape that we have today. And that goes for managing problems in patients, both through healthcare providers, through insurance, through pharma, and also direct to consumer as well.
And do you subscribe to this theory that healthcare is hard, you know, in terms of building a business, starting a business, scaling a business? Is it, from your experience of having been an investor for a number of years, is it like objectively any harder than any other space, or is it just sort of horses for courses and every space is hard because starting businesses and being successful at starting a business is hard?
Look, I think as a broader team, we invest across all main verticals within software-enabled technology. So fintech, consumer tech, B2B SaaS, health tech, deep tech and fintech. You know, each vertical has its own idiosyncratic challenges. I wouldn't say one is any harder than the other. It's just the individual challenges per vertical are different and take a very different skill set, both by the management team, but also, frankly, by the investor, to understand those challenges and try and mitigate, you know, challenges around them. So, you know, some of the dynamics that you have in health tech is the amount of data that's required to evidence that a technology is efficacious but also safe tends to be far higher than, for example, what you have in consumer tech, where challenges wouldn't apply. There have been some very useful studies done by Bessemer, which show it takes roughly 3 years longer than your average B2B SaaS platform to get to that, you know, sort of holy grail of 100 million revenue number. And that's due to the facts, as I said, having to prove out the data from the technology works, and also in many cases surpass regulatory clearance before that product is scaled in the open market. Those challenges just take time. And
I would agree with you. So just so everyone's on the same page, the report that Jess was referencing was a report that was released, I think, earlier this year by Bessemer. Bessemer's a huge, very successful venture capital fund based out of the US, but they operate globally. And I it was around the sort of pathways to exit, I guess, or sort of why the healthcare space was different and how it was different. I think as soon as it came out, probably every single health tech entrepreneur had downloaded that globally within about 15 minutes. It seemed to go around on LinkedIn like wildfire. It was sort of like the health tech equivalent of, you know, the dress where like you see it's yellow and you some people see it's green. It was like the health tech equivalent of that. It just like went like wildfire. So I agree with you. I think the for me, yeah, having worked across a number of different sectors previously, as well as now health technology, the regulatory landscape, clearly, but there are other regulated sectors like fintech, right? So that sort of, is it slightly more regulated? There's the clinical safety aspect, there's the clinical research aspect. There's certainly a much, much higher sort of bar for acceptance or adoption. And there's a much greater risk of sort of lapsed adoption. So for example, pathways change, regulation changes, attitudes, clinical evidence shifts, some new innovation comes out. I think within the consumer sector, there seems to be a bit of an approach, which is if consumers are buying it, then it works. And if they're not, then it doesn't. Whereas that doesn't really apply to healthcare. There's a lot more objectivity around the gating factors as to why something will start, will scale. You know, that's how I think about it. I don't know what you think.
No, completely agree. And that's not to say that health tech companies can't, you know, test out their product in different go-to-market strategies. I mean, we typically do see that, and some are easier to access than others. The bar is very high with a provider or indeed with pharma. But you might find, you know, less so the case if you're going through a partnership model where you know, you can rely on their brand capability and reach more so. So it really depends. But yes, overall, I would completely agree with you. And we'd love to hear how you've approached that and tackled that challenge with PulpDoc.
It's one of, so my background previously was in a number of things, but predominantly I was one of the early employees at a very, very, very successful business within the event ticketing space, probably the most successful live entertainment business that's come out of the UK and Europe in the last 30 years. And so I started their commercial group when I was 25 and grew that to be extremely successful. And the learnings that I took from that to bring it into healthcare, some have come across and some haven't. And I think the trying to find this middle ground between the very traditional approach, which is highly sequential, which is we do one thing, then we do another, then we do another in a linear line, versus the non-regulated sector, which is you try and move hyper fast as much as you can, and you accept that some things will work, you look at what works, you iterate. Trying to find a middle ground there has been one of the major areas I believe that I've added value to the company, to the startup that we have, is trying to sort of weave those two things together. I think the biggest thing that we did from the beginning was focus absolutely with a laser focus on what the problem was that we were solving for patients and for systems and for clinicians. And it took us a really long time to get that down. Luckily, when you develop a medical device, you're somewhat obligated to go through that process anyway, although many people don't, but you should be going through that process anyway as part of your product development cycle. We benefited from the fact that we were highly focused on the cardiometabolic pathway. So one of my observations around the health technology space, healthcare space, is that there's a lot of people that are very excited about their technology that they've built, extremely excited about that, and they're less worried about finding out what the real problem is and understanding the scale of that problem and understanding how that problem is currently being managed, is currently being monetized, who is paying for that, who will pay for a solution, and then fitting your technology solution into that pathway at the right moment. And maybe maybe it means a complete redesign of that pathway, or maybe you just neatly slot into it and you save cost or make it more efficient. But what one of the things that I've consistently seen, particularly with businesses that have highly technical founders and no commercial founders, is that there's a fantastic, and this is really prevalent in diagnostics as well, I believe, it is sort of my box is better than your box, my photo sensors are better than your photo sensors, you know, sort of trying to win on an engineering point. And actually, when you get down to it, no one really cares about that. You know, there's an assumption that your technology is good. There's an assumption that it works. There's an assumption that it's accurate and so on. You're not going to win in that space unless you really solve a problem. And actually, it's that, it, when you go through that process, and I think this is my theory. I haven't confirmed this with objective data, but when you operate in businesses, maybe outside of healthcare or outside of academia, it's accepted that 9 times out of 10, you're going to be wrong in your theses, but you tried it, you learn, you iterate, you tried it, you learn, you iterate. Whereas the idea for a lot of individuals I've encountered in academia or in highly technical areas, the idea that they could be wrong is very difficult for them to understand and very difficult for them to get their head around, because this is their solution based on their research that they've done. And so you're the problem for not understanding how great their solution is. So, and actually, if you're going to really understand patient problems, payer problems, provider problems, clinician problems, you're going to have to eat a lot of humble pie and understand that actually what you've developed may not work very well. And actually, you may have to adapt and you may have to do different things. And so that's kind of the approach that we've taken at PocDoc, which was really focus on the problem, really focus on the pathway. We already knew the kind of, I guess, broad landing zone of where our technology would be. But we then tried, and we had loads and loads of interactions with clinicians and patients and providers and things like that went really badly, basically, at the beginning. And they were like, well, this won't work. you know, this won't work for this. And sort of some tons of our theses went out. But actually, through that process, you start to refine. And I think it's the, and then I'll let you talk, which is the whole point of this podcast. So apologies. But you did ask. So, you know, is this openness to exploring different avenues in parallel versus a sequential linear approach, I think is something that's benefited us. And you can still do it safely, you can still do it with clinical oversight, you can still do it within the rules and regs, but this idea that you're going to look at different things, try different things, and then work that out, but that you have this laser focus on actually this is the problem that we solve. I mean, one of the things just randomly on PocDoc that we realized was that just the ability to have an app that captures data digitally during a screening interaction, that in itself is a step forward. Before you even layer in the blood test and the quantitative and the heart risk assessment and all that on the integration in the record. So you only really get that where you actually go and do the boots on the ground thing. Anyway, sorry, over to you.
No, I completely agree with your observations. And you've touched on a really important point for us as an investment team, like that elasticity of mindset around solving for the outcome and underlying needs rather than obsessing on the enabling technology is hugely important for us. And it's something we acutely test as we're getting comfortable on a company or an opportunity. I think one of the common pitfalls I've noticed within teams that fall foul to that dynamic is when the tech team and the product team almost operate and become as one rather than two separate entities getting well within a company. I would say structuring for success in that regard early on, whereby you have, you know, two different minds leading up those separate functions. Obviously, communication between the two is absolutely paramount for success. But we like to see, you know, the product team been externally facing, thinking about usability, adoption, underlying KPIs for measurement of the product, whereas the tech team are thinking about, you know, is this the right approach? How do we need to test it at scale? How do we scale it? And how do we prove that it works? But those
one of the things that I noticed was that having come from a more traditional tech background, you know, tech with a capital T, was that and then moving into a sort of medical device type, diagnostics type, you know, health technology field, was that the definition of product and product development is very different on spec, which is in tech with a capital T, product owners, product development is really geared around customer success, right? Really focused on that. Whereas in traditional, you know, health technology world, and I'm not talking about regulation, so if people want to start, I'm not saying you're operating outside of the regs, just the mindset is hugely focused on hardware development, physical development. It's not worrying a huge amount about what's going to happen with the customer and what the customer wants. And actually that process of product development of physical product is actually extraordinarily cumbersome at times. And so being sophisticated, which was another thing that we are at PocDoc, being sophisticated about how you can move through that product development cycle can make a transformative difference to your route to market and your speed to market.
Yeah, and I think, like, bringing it back to health tech as well, specifically, one of the, like, often challenges health tech companies have to go through is system change. You know, some companies are lucky enough that they can slot into an existing process and there's zero change required. That's, like, seldom the case. And companies that do have to affect system change really have to think very acutely about, you know, how will the underlying user, so most times a healthcare provider or clinician, how will the underlying, like, user and deliverer of this product, like, think, feel, you know, worry about their role changing? You know, they've grown up in an industry where they've trained for a very long period of time, accepting a status quo of technology that's very different to what you're trying to introduce. And some specific examples would be the likes of AI and radiology. You know, we've seen years clinicians worry about, you know, what the adoption of that AI will mean for their role. Actually, there's been some very recent research to suggest that the second look by radiologists is still more accurate than many of the AI solutions. There's also conflicting data, and particularly NICE, who work in partnership with the NHS, have done a very long study to show that there's many tools out there that are, you know, as accurate as the sort of the human second look, and are now introducing 9 solutions into the NHS for that second look review.
Oh, nice. Which ones are going in? Do we know? Have they published them, or is it just like, hey, we've selected 9?
Yeah, they're all on NICE's website.
Oh, so cool.
all are fairly like well established, like tested and proven solutions, but we'll start to see the impact of them trickle through over the course of this year and next, which is hugely impactful for the sector. But particularly the fear of, you know, how that will change the day-to-day of the radiologist has been a huge challenge in adoption for the last couple of years that we've been looking at the technologies. So it's a great step forward.
Do you back anyone in that space? Does Octopus have anything in that space?
In AI for radiology, so far, no, but definitely keeping a close for watch over what the future look of that space looks like.
I think while we're on the subject of AI, we can kind of talk about ChatGPT in healthcare just before we go to our first break. What are your thoughts about it first before I obviously go off on my own little soapbox?
Yeah, so I think like the broader field of generative AI in healthcare, I think, you know, there's a huge potential to save a lot of administrative hours for clinicians. In terms of applications today, here and now, I think what is safe and reliable is automation and use of generative AI in like sort of administrative processes. I think what I'm really excited about looking forward is use of generative AI and clinical applications to help support the clinician. And there's, you know, many companies out there such as Druid, such as Click, that are building long-term data models for clinical application. But starting today in automation, you know, of administrative processes, which I think in terms of, you know, patient safety and outcomes is absolutely the right approach. But I get very excited when we think about the longer term applications once there's reliable, you know, LLMs built with, you know, useful clinical data. So, yeah, those are my thoughts.
I would agree. I think that anything involved automation, administration, efficiency is a complete no-brainer and probably on the safe end of the spectrum. I think that there's a huge amount of work for regulators, both but at a I guess medical device level, so as well as at a nice local health authority level. They need to really, my biggest concern is that either they don't catch up, won't want to catch up, can't catch up, and they stifle the innovation, or that they don't catch up, can't catch up, and the thing just goes out anyway, and there's a huge risk. So in theory, if you're a medical device, whether you're AI or software as a medical device or hardware, you have to have full traceability and auditability on every component in your device, which somewhat runs against some of the foundations of some of these generative AI models. And so I think it's a hugely valuable area and has got the opportunity to completely transform any sector, not just healthcare, any sector pretty much. But the traceability and the regulatory oversight is going to be absolutely critical. So I think they're either going to be able to nail it to be able to foster that positively, or they're going to fluff it and we'll either have, you know, the Wild West and things will be out there and there'll be problems, or there just won't be anything because no one can get anything through. Which will then like have a downstream impact on investment and ability to raise. And maybe I would imagine the FDA will probably be ahead of the curve on this because they generally seem to be. And I suspect probably there's significantly more investment going into this stuff in the US, obviously. So I suspect they'll get it right. So I don't know. I think the EU's generally always been a little bit, you know, bearish on some of this stuff traditionally. So we'll just have to see. That's my take on it.
Yeah, and I think you raise an important point in that the only way we'll have future applications within a clinical field is if we start today, like fostering and building those data assets that can be used for future benefit and gain. So there's definitely still investment opportunity. But to be clear, I think we need to spend a lot of time thinking about what's the right infrastructure, what's the right regulation, and how do we build for success for the long term, you know, rather than about what are the day one applications today within the clinical field. But we do have to start now. Otherwise, as you say, we will be significantly behind the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so we have to go for our first commercial break now. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Jess McCready, Principal Investor at Octopus Investment Fund. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Good, Hello, welcome back to the second part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Jess McCready, Principal Investor at Octopus Ventures. I'm having problems with my words today. So before the break, we were talking about a whole bunch of things, including the application of generative AI in healthcare. Let's change it up a little bit now, and let's talk a little bit about some of the investments that you've made that we talked about previously before the show that you wanted to sort of highlight. So I know that you've done some stuff in digital therapeutics like Sleepio, which is Big Health, Quit Genius. And I think we've also talked about this. I definitely talked about it last week with Chris from General Catalyst, and we also talked about it in our pre-show briefing, which is this idea of there's an investment thesis as to why you invest in any particular sector or any particular business, and understanding how that thesis gets built. But then there's also this sort of unknown around, it's the right thesis, but was it executed right? We've seen examples around that. Babylon's a good one, but let's start there. How do you want to sort of begin this discussion?
Yeah, so look, we are hypothesis driven, but also very reactive as well, as to sort of what the shorter term or sort of evolving technologies we see in the market within any given year. So we do spend a lot of time as a team, writing and sharing thought leadership on the sort of the higher level hypotheses we're excited by. But as an investment team, if that's the only way you operate, you will inevitably miss technologies because you can't foresee every technology or company that comes up to raise every single year. So we act in both ways as a team. And then in terms of what are the long-term trends that we're excited by? So as a team, we invest in software-enabled technologies. We do also and have done invested in companies that have hardware as part of their stack as well. And we've been very successful in doing so. Whereas a lot of technology investors, but specifically health investors, often tend to shy away from hardware. I think within health tech, which you often don't have in other verticals, is hardware is often in absolutely necessary for
at some point you have to interact with the patient, and so
it's very helpful, and I've had some personal success in that space as well. So I think you should build a team acknowledging that will often be part of the required approach to the underlying patient. Some of the companies we've backed, so we think about very long-term, large addressable market trends. Fertility is one example. So Overture, our portfolio company, who are building solutions to automate fertility and fertility services, so IVF and egg freezing, which has some really quite catastrophic high-level stats insofar as the cost of a single IVF cycle can be upwards of $10,000. Success rate of any given cycle is highly volatile depending on the underlying fertility clinic that you're engaging with, but roughly around 20%. So what that means is on average each couple will have to go through 5 cycles before they get a positive outcome, which in the UK we're lucky enough to have a reimbursed scheme for 2 cycles, but at the moment there's fairly long wait lists, and obviously during that time of waiting the couple's fertility often decreases.
Yeah, also I'm not sure quite when that kicks in either. I think you have to do something where you have to wait for a certain number of years before, and then I'm not sure quite now whether the waiting list that you're on only starts when you've done the waiting for a number of years. I'm not quite sure whether it runs concurrently, but that could be a big problem for a lot of people.
Absolutely, and there's also huge regional variations as well. So I think what we thought quite deeply around how do you solve the underlying bottlenecks, and there's some fantastic companies within fertility tech solving the connection barrier. So how do you better access the appropriate point of care at the right time? And we've seen some amazing marketplaces and tech ecosystem platforms scale up to solve that. When we took a deep dive into the space, we felt actually one of the major barriers is the volatility of outcomes, depending on what fertility clinic you access, as well as the global shortage of embryologists. And when we made the investment into Overture, they were one of the only at the time and still today, one of the most successful from a data set perspective, solving that exact challenge.
And how do they solve it? What's their sort of secret sauce? Well, you're the publicly available secret sauce, not the secret sauce.
Yeah, so the company are still in R&D phase. They'll be working towards commercial launch next year. And what they've done so far is they've proven their ability to automate some of the most technically challenging workflows within the IVF cycle. So they've started with oocyte vitrification, which is cryo-freezing of the underlying oocyte, which is the female egg. And they've now built a fantastic product in that space, which is, as I said, we'll go through commercial launch next year. They've also built an automated ICSI, which is an automated robot, which does the insemination of the oocyte using the sperm sample.
Okay.
And they've also built a metabolomic solution, which tests the underlying health of the oocyte.
And were those some of the key failure points, if you like, or are those some of the key failure points in this, or sort of determinants of the success rate of any given cycle?
Yeah, absolutely. So they've started on where we see where we see the highest volatility from an outcomes perspective. And then the plan over the next couple of years, once commercially launched, will be to launch that as a platform that can be a full stack solution for fertility clinics to rely on, which we firmly believe will unblock some of the major challenges in that space, being access to embryologists. You know, who have enough experience, which is often more than 10 years in practice before they can manage this type of cycle, and also give more reliability on outcomes to the underlying patients who are trying to access this type of service.
So they want to almost be like the infrastructure, if you like, behind the front end of the fertility clinics.
Absolutely.
That makes a lot of sense. That's super interesting.
Yeah, so that's a very long-term theme, and we've seen fertility globally drop off, and we've also seen couples typically, especially in the Western world, look to have families later on in life, you know, prioritizing career and other parts of life ahead of having a family. So there's been a huge amount of research done actually on the reasons for declining female fertility. But there's also been a decline in male fertility. But so far, not as many research studies, or at least conclusive.
I've read these headlines as well, and I'm completely honest, I haven't looked into the articles, I haven't read any of the data. So take that as read. But when they say fertility is declining, do they mean number of children per person, or do they actually mean on any given, you know, I don't know what the term would be, actually on an almost like for like basis, people are unable to have as many children or are not being as successful at getting pregnant or having children as they were previously?
So the average number of children per family in the Western world has declined, as you can imagine, but also the underlying fertility of both females.
Everyone.
Has also dropped, and as I said, like, causation has been proven within females, or at least there's indications as to why that is. One of the major ones being waiting until later life. The female fertility sort of peaks at age 27, and then starts to go into, unfortunately, terminal decline thereafter. And it varies person to person, but that's sort of the average model.
Right.
And the male side, I forget the drop-off point, but I think it was about 1950s or so, male sperm virality has dropped off in the order of 50% since then, from the wow. Test that was in the paper I read.
Do they think that's like environmental, societal? Yeah,
so at the moment it's all hypotheses. There's no concrete conclusions as to why that is, but yeah, sort of exposure to plastics, exposure to harmful environmental gases are sort of some of the main hypotheses, but so far.
Is there a connection between like overall health and sperm motility? Like, for example, people are unhealthier than they were in the 1950s, like on a kind of cardio metabolic basis. I don't know if that's got a connection or not really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some fantastic health tech companies within that space, such as Mojo, who offer, you know, point of care diagnostics for sperm virality. And if you were to have one of those tests done, like, some of the most often recommendations are linked to, you know, diet, lifestyle and exercise. So, yes, absolutely. There's a very clear link between overall health and sperm virality.
Right. Yeah. It's funny how a lot of this stuff basically just comes back to the same things: diet, lifestyle, you know, living more healthily.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, as you mentioned at the start of the hour, you know, lifestyle change as a sort of go to market approach and also an investment approach is very challenging.
Hugely challenging.
You're very reliant on attitudes, you know, sort of volatility of those attitudes, and doing that over the long term for many lifestyle linked diseases is proven quite challenging. Which I would, in the likes of weight loss, some of the new categories of drugs that we've seen come to market in the last couple of years is really exciting.
But though, do you not think that, like, those, there are so many businesses that basically got saved, you know, like fairly generic digital weight loss that just got rescued because of, I mean, literally got pulled out of the fire because now they can basically prescribe or put people on the pathway to, you know, Wegovy, semaglutide.
Yeah, I mean, there's various stats out there, but it's roughly 15% of Americans have already used a GLP-1, which is quite phenomenal.
Yeah, it's insane.
Adoption outside of the US, I mean, it's a huge, you know, only just tapped opportunity. And I think that weight loss is challenging. So I think to do that over the long term, only relying on behaviour change, you know, we do see a lot of, unfortunately, patients relapse into old habits. So yes, I think now that they do have prescribing capabilities has been hugely helpful to their long-term success. But I'm a firm believer in, you know, both working together is, you know, should result in a better outcome. You know, they just rely on a stick.
Yeah. I mean, there's data that suggests, well, very strongly suggests, perhaps even you could go so far as to, like, empirically states that if you are on a GLP-1 or a semaglutide and you don't undergo any kind of behavior change or weight loss treatment, psychological treatment, or however, sort of clinical treatment around your attitude to diet and exercise, that it all just goes back on after you stop the treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, it's been a really exciting evolution for the space.
Yeah, I think so. What we've found so far with POCDOC, of all of the people that we've tested so far or have been screened using POCDOC, whether that's in the NHS or pharmacies or workplaces or any other places that we're rolling out with, we found over 30% of people, because we capture BMI at the same time as all of the other cardiometabolic markers. So we do sort of the equivalent of the NHS health check in 8 minutes anywhere. And 30% of people that we've tested had a BMI that would have meant that they would be able to get semaglutide prescribed.
It's amazing.
Very exciting. just finding these people, and they're not even on anybody's radar. So one of the challenges that we are now working on is, how do we move people through, whether it's a, you know, non-pharmaceutical, pharmaceutical, whatever it is, some combined solution, so that we can do the entire pathway. So not just for weight loss, but also for lipid lowering therapies. And we've got HbA1c coming out, which then opens up type 2 diabetes and things like that. But it's the ability to digitize the entire pathway and find people that should be on that. But the scale of the issue, if you just look at BMI, is a massive, massive problem everywhere, I would suspect, in the European, US, probably all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, like, obesity is unfortunately a risk factor for most long-term chronic illnesses that we tend to suffer with in the Western world. So it's hugely important that we get this right. And like, enabling technology that's been significantly invested in over the years is the likes of, you know, CBT, but we're also quite significant development within others, like neuromodulation, which we're really excited by within the field of weight loss, but also various other applications as well.
Well, let's get into neuromodulation after our next break, because that sounds extremely, that sounds great. So we are going to have a final commercial break now. Jess McCready, principal investor from Octopus Ventures. We will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Jess McCready, who is principal investor at Octopus Ventures, one of the leading early stage and growth investors in health and healthcare technologies in the UK and Europe. So Jess, just before the break, we were talking about weight loss and enabling software. And you mentioned something which you thought was very exciting, which is called neuromodulation, which I've not actually I understand what the two words mean, and I can sort of, you know, extrapolate where we're going, but it's not a field that I'm necessarily familiar with. So what is that, and why do you think that's so exciting?
Yeah, I think we've seen neuromodulation been applied in a number of verticals, so both within cardiac health, mental health, and also weight loss, to name just a few. Many of the solutions that we've seen, so this is using electrical signals to go through the brain to stimulate a physical response within the body. Many of the approaches we've seen have been invasive, so going under the dermal layer so that they can access often the vagus nerve, but other parts of the anatomy. That has its challenges insofar as it has quite an expensive and long regulatory process.
Yeah, if you're going down the implantable route, get ready. You better be well funded, because that's going to take a while.
Yeah, and we've also seen some really exciting companies that have developed technology that is non-invasive. So to call one out in the atrial fibrillation and heart failure space is a business called Parasim. And their sort of form factor is such that they just attach to the earlobe, and through that they're able to access the vagus nerve. And they're still in R&D phase, but have been able to evidence clinical data sets within atrial fibrillation and heart failure, which is very exciting.
Mm. What do you mean they reduce it, or they just measure it?
No, reduction of the symptoms.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And already a number of companies within that space in commercial application within, for example, mental health and weight loss.
Yeah, there's quite a lot in. There's a few in that space, but that sounds incredible. Did you say Parasim?
Parasim, yeah. But when you think about the application from a clinical perspective with that type of technology, I mean, heart failure and heart disease is the biggest killer globally. And when you can approach the patient through a non-invasive form factor, it's a really, really exciting, opportunity.
I completely agree. Neuromodulation. Everyone, it's a new one for the show. So I know that we've got a little bit of time left in the show, and I know that we didn't even touch on your background, and I think that actually, luckily, if that makes sense, it's good to touch on it now, because it leads into the sort of, I think, a wider discussion around your view and your feeling around the diversity within investment and venture capital and things like that. So why don't you give us a quick, you know, a bit of an overview about your journey to where you are, principal investor, and, you know, what your view is generally around this issue of diversity within the investment space, because I know it's been something that's been talked about quite rightly for a number of years now. And yeah, just thought it'd be an interesting topic to sort of finish the show up on.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background, I left university, wanted to go into banking and finance. I was fascinated by like finance and also what it took to scale a successful company. So at the time, you know, going into investment banking felt like the most obvious route for me. And I guess my career, as I look at it, is probably split into three parts so far. Started off in banking, and through that understood how to structure companies at scale from a capital perspective and also get to exit. My sector specialism was actually not in healthcare, it was in infrastructure and energy. But my main takeaway from that was I absolutely loved working with companies that were producing energy and also infrastructure that was sustainable and often renewable. Was probably less attached to the finite energy work that I did in oil and gas, which actually was a good signal to me in that I really love working in a sector where you can create positive social and system change constant throughout my career. The middle part of my career was spent at a large corporate called Legal & General, so one of the UK's or the UK's biggest pension manager and term insurer, and they are a very large financial services organisation, and my role there was actually I was investing the principal balance sheets, where we had, I guess, an impact focus insofar as we were trying to do good for a broader society and obviously return, a commercial return for the capital we're investing. So it was a very large pot of capital that we were deploying. And I sort of played a number of roles in the strategy during my time there, initially in infrastructure, then investing into venture capital. And before I'd left, I'd set up a health tech VC strategy where we're investing in health technology strategically. And a strategic motivation there was, you know, L&G's balance sheet is probably the most exposed to health and life risk.
Yeah, because it's an insurance company, right?
Exactly. So my strategy was to invest in health tech that was preventative and predictive in nature. Where possible, help those companies scale up through commercial, you know, partnerships with the broader organization. So I guess that then taught me how to build within a large corporate, and how specifically to partner with large organizations when you're, you know, a very early stage entrant into the space.
And what was it that drew you? Because you committed to the financial services sector or the financial pathway pretty early on, by the sounds of it. So what was there a moment or an experience that you had in your formative years where you realized that was the pathway, or was it more organic than that?
I think it was probably quite organic in the sense that, like, I always enjoyed maths, like, loved thinking about, like, how to scale, like, how the idiosyncrasies of a particular sector, like, what that looks like in terms of a company P&L. And that, like, that just, it sounds quite sad, but that really.
No, I mean, you know, like, what, there's that famous story about Warren Buffett, if you've ever read the book Snowball, where, like, you know, at the age of 14, he'd memorized all of the balance sheets of the S&P 500. And, like, you know, when he went to college, when he was like 16, he, like, his party trick at the frat house was to, like, that people named a company and he would, like, give the whole thing. So was it a bit like that?
I'd love to say I could do that, but definitely. but, you know, similar, like, I like maths is very factual. It's often very binary, and that appeals to me. But I have to say, like, the evolution that I've gone through in my career is actually, I'd say equal parts left brain as I am right brain. And what technology gives me is, like, quite a creative solution to problem solving. So I love doing both in my day to day. So I love, like, the very, like, factual use of numbers, like financials, modeling, like, that appeals to me in terms of, you know, my sort of left brain thinking. Yeah. And then right brain, like, I love thinking about, okay, this is, you know, we're seeing life expectancy, you know, taking the example of being sat within legal in general, life expectancy from around 2018 started to flatten out in the UK. And it's, you know, because as to our point at the start of the call, like, a lot of our healthcare costs are on long term, you know, non-cure chronic disease, and to enable that sort of longevity curve to continue to rise, we need to see more investment and more scalability within preventative forms of healthcare. So that like problem solving and thinking for me was, you know, what can we invest in and help scale to help affect that system change? And investing in technologies and working with companies at the sort of the early stage innovator part of their life cycle, you know, really appeals to me in terms of working creatively and problem solving. So the blend of the two is really important to me. And the third part of my career has been, you know, investing in venture capital within VC funds. So working at Octopus Ventures and helping me to work with my companies and what it looks like to build from the ground up, which has just been a very different part of the risk cycle, but an enjoyable one from where I've worked before. But I think if you think about the steps in my career, I've sort of worked at the very latest stage and then gone all the way down to the very early stage. And I think knowing what good looks like at scale has been really helpful to me in my career and helping me to work with the companies that I work with to build for success.
Makes sense. And so what's your opinion currently on the sort of, diversity is a pretty catch-all word, but I don't have a better one for it. So what's your view on that sort of issue within what you experience and have experienced currently?
Yeah, so I think I've only ever worked in companies / sectors where diversity is a topic for discussion and improvement. So investment banking also has its own challenges within this space. And I'm lucky insofar as all the companies I've worked for, this has been at the forefront of their thinking to, you know, we need to solve this. We need to have a better ratio between males and females. When we think about diversity, we think about it in all manners of diversity. So ethnicity, educational, social status, gender is often one that started on because the split is very clear societally. And, you know, in order to get to the to a more healthy balance, you know, many companies have introduced things like, you know, quotas or indeed boards have, but that can also have negative outcomes. So as a team, you know, we are lucky enough to be broadly 50-50 as an investment team. And we've been quite public in what our messaging to the market is. So by 2025, we want 30% of all new founder pitches to our investment team to be either led or co-led by a female.
And how are you going to enforce that on a case by case basis, basically?
So we've been public about it, which enforces.
Right, it's a first step.
So it's the first step. That's obviously an input, not an outcome. But in order to effect change, you know, there's an evolution that has to take place. And we feel this is the most appropriate place to start. And then by 2027, that number will increase to 50%. So the hope and the desire is that our portfolio, which is now roughly 25% female or female co-led companies, then becomes more like 50%
right. by. Yeah, I mean, we, you know, back in the early days of when we were doing things, my co-founder, who's a woman, she's also my wife, she was on one of these sort of what was it called, sort of an angel network for women, so female angel network, trying to sort of invest in early stage businesses that had a founder or co-founder that was a woman. And at the pitch event, she was the only woman pitching. There was like six companies pitching, and all the male founders pitched, and the female co-founder just sat there quietly. I was appalled. It was ridiculous. I'm like, what's the I don't understand. Like, why wouldn't you, like, surely that's slightly counterintuitive, right? I don't know. That's just my thought.
Yeah, and you do, like I mentioned earlier, we invest in very different, a broad number of verticals. You do see variances between verticals, but actually within healthcare, you know, the workforce within healthcare is actually more weighted towards females. So you would expect, you know, if the founders are coming from a clinical background, that you see more of a blend or a bias towards females within health tech. But sadly, you know, not the case. There is, in our view, very much you know, sort of a top of the funnel supply challenge, and we do need to work with females and female teams on entrepreneurship. And
I think there's also, like, I mean, I could probably talk about this forever. I know my wife could do like 10 shows on this. It's a real personal bugbear for her. But there's another issue, which is around the expectation of founders in general. So one of the pieces of feedback that my wife also had from another VC that was an early stage VC was that it was a red flag for them that she wanted to spend a day a week looking after our children and do a blended role. It's like, well, and that was a female VC that said that to her.
Goodness.
And you're like, well, and that's a UK based VC, by the way. So I will not name names, but I think that there's a lot of like there's sort of this idea that a founder has to work 100-hour weeks or whatever it happens to be. And ultimately that's not conducive to many people's lives. And so I don't know. I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
No, I think, you know, as an industry, we're going through a big system change. I think the perception of a tech entrepreneur in the early 2000s was, you know, a white Caucasian male, probably went to an Ivy League US school, got 3 hours sleep underneath his desk.
So yeah. Yeah.
Not conducive to, you know, most types of individuals, but not least, you know, people that have a family to look after. So no, that is definitely not our view, and we actively seek diversity, not just in the founding team, but the broader management team of our companies. And the stats, like, speak for themselves. There was this is actually more from a VC fund perspective than a VC stage company perspective, but there was a really interesting report. Which was published a couple of months ago by European Women in BC. So they produce a report every year on the landscape. And this latest report, I don't know if you saw it, but they've summarised that management teams mostly comprised of women outperform men-only teams by an order of 9.3%. And that's from a VC fund perspective.
I'm not surprised. I'm really not surprised. And I'm not surprised necessarily because it's gender necessarily. It's just that men and women approach problems differently in general. I'm being generalized, and they think about things very differently, in my experience of having done this for a while. And actually you end up with a much better outcome if you have a plurality of opinion as opposed to just a very narrow selection of opinion. And, you know, I completely agree anecdotally with that data.
Yeah, I think, like, the portfolio companies that we have that come to, like, more constructive, more informed, like, better strategic decisions are those that have a diverse team. So I think a negative outcome of that report would be to say that all venture capitalists should be VCs. I'm not saying to be females. I'm not saying that's the case.
No.
But definitely, like, more diversity is better, and getting to, you know, better constructed, well-informed debates and views.
Makes sense. Well, on that note, Jess, we've come to the end of the show. So thank you very much for coming on. Much appreciated. Jess McCready, Principal Investor of Octopus Ventures. And thanks to everyone for listening.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio.